Had a hell of a lot of consultants around here.
Did you?
In various, yes. Did a lot of different studies.
You say that.
I mean, I had, we had, you know, quite a bit of marketing personnel here doing research. It wasn't, I think, later, they have a formal market research people here.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we did whatever we could.
Have you ever had any copyright challenges from any of the journals about use of their title pages or any of those kinds of things?
Yes, various kinds. Some, but I don't think we ever got into any litigation per se. At one point, I got into a big fracas with Robert Maxwell, but that was not because of the contents page thing in itself. It was just that he was trying to harass me, you know. So, did I describe any of that in the previous?
No. What happened there?
Robert Maxwell.
When was this?
It's got to be over 30 years ago. He sued us for copyright violation, okay? And that was his way of trying to exert a wedge. They wanted to try and buy my company. He used to go around and do these power plays, you know. He did that to Biosis at one point. He'd go and say, well, if you don't let me buy you out, I'll put you out of business, basically. And he made up his mind a long time ago. I met Maxwell a long, long time ago. Probably in 61. I probably met him 30 years ago or more. And in any event, at some point he sued us for copyright violation, and my lawyers were pretty clever. It's Arthur Seidel and Edward Gonda, the latter is now dead, but we subpoenaed him, and Maxwell showed up in my lawyer's office. He had to show up to take his testimony, and discovered that he himself was in violation of copyright laws because he was printing journals outside the requirements of the then copyright law. You could only print so many copies of those things out of the United States. And so right in the middle of the whole thing, when he found out that he was really caught, hoisted on his own petard, as it were. So, he said, let's forget about all this crap and I'll buy your company out.
That was the first you knew that was his ploy?
Well, I don't know about the first, but, you know. And so the result of all that was that he had to sign an agreement. We signed an agreement that gave us the right to not only photocopy his contents, but he had to supply us with two copies of each of his journals on demand at our discretion. But in exchange for that, we gave him a free subscription to our publications. And he used to use that. You know, he turned around and he even took the Science Citation Index and sold it. Because he had a subscription agency. See? So he could take an order for it and then take his copy and supply it that way. But and then we had the right to photocopy any article from any Pergamon journal for $1, which in those days seemed like a lot of money to him. But as the years went by, it's got lower and lower.
You still have that right?
No, I think that eventually that
expired.
And it was a really long, like 30 years.
Yeah. Now, you countersued him?
I wouldn't say we countersued him. As a result of his suit.
The terms of the settlement.
We, however that were, yeah, the settlement. Mm-hmm. Was
interesting. Any other interesting legal?
And then, by the way, he later on, well, much later on, he again tried to buy my company. When I was in negotiation with Ted Cross for to you know make the partnership with Ted Cross, he called me from his yacht and made me this offer. And what happened was somewhere along the line, what happened was a former member, some more former members of our board of directors who had ISI stock, sold their stock to Maxwell. And that gave me a lot of headaches. Hmm. And then he tried to use that as a wedge to buy the company.
So he owned some?
He owned about 6 or 7% through that vehicle. And then eventually he was frozen out by Ted Cross, legally.
Yeah, interesting.
But even that he sued. He sued them.
Oh, he did?
Yeah, and that litigation, by the way, was still on when he died.
Oh, wow. Mm.
And then eventually the whoever came after that, I guess they settled it one way or another. I don't know how they did it. It was just all outrageous harassment.
Yeah. Any other interesting legal battles? Because I haven't looked into this much at all that you've had over the years. About the company?
Oh, there was one journal that sued us not for copyright, but for just the opposite, because we wouldn't cover all of his journals. And took the position that we were like a dominating force in the market, that we, without being included in current contents, he couldn't survive and so forth. Yeah.
How did you respond to this?
Well, we won that case.
Yes.
But it wasn't... he claimed that we were discriminating, that we covered his competitor. And, you know, we proved... we tried to prove, of course, that we did that on reasonable grounds. And he had a journal. It wasn't really a journal. It was an annual and so forth. It was some spectroscopy journal. Mm-hmm. So eventually that got solved. Yeah.
How did you make decisions over the years about changing the contents of current contents? Mm-hmm. Was it citation analysis kind of thing?
It was partly that, but we relied on the drug companies knew what they wanted. Uh-huh. And after a while, when you're covering the core, from then on, you're just covering, you're beginning to cover the periphery. And if there were new journals, I mean, after all, if a journal is started by an academic press or by an American Chemical Society or by some highly reputable publisher, you know that they've already done the marketing. They know that they've got a niche. Mm-hmm. And in those days, our policy was not to cover them instantly. We waited until they were out for a year. But I mean, American Chemical Society, you're going to have the pressure from people right away if it's relevant. Mm-hmm. You can't leave it out.
But it's
too significant a journal.
Yeah. In some cases, would you do counts of some type?
We had the citation data, you're talking about, after all, we didn't have SCI back before 64, to do that. So in the early days, we just did it by various means. Although, even then... but fundamentally, of course, we had the first list that we had of what we called the Journal Citation Index, told us what the most significant journals were then.
Mm-hmm.
And then, after a while, you get to know a good journal from a bad one. You can tell, you can evaluate a journal. So many factors that you just look at it intrinsically, you can tell.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, but... Now, to this day, of course, there's a huge amount of resentment out there in the third world that we don't cover everything that they publish. And there's also still a lot of great deal of misrepresentation about the number of journals, that, because there's always people kicking around and using numbers about the numbers of journals, which are meaningless. It's not the number of journals that counts, it's the number of articles that are published that count. So there are huge numbers of small, trivial journals that, you know, have some reason for existence, presumably, out there. Somebody's ego is being satisfied, but it doesn't mean they're justified that we have to cover them. But it wouldn't hurt if they were, although some customers would argue that it would clutter up. We had a few cases of journals that were real trash, it turned out. We allowed to get through the...
Oh, yeah.
We had to get rid of them. Yeah, it was one journal in nutrition where I realized after we published it for about a year, the only articles were published by one person. It was the guy that published it. You know. How the hell did that get in here?
A vanity journal. Huh?
Yeah, well, it wasn't refereed.
Yeah.
No. So, but they've got a whole elaborate group down here today. Journal evaluation group here.
Mm-hmm.
They spend a lot of time looking at these journals because it is an expense. I mean, you can figure, you know, what does it cost to index an article? And a lot of the journals involved translation of titles and other problems. So,
now, size-wise, how did you make your decisions there, particularly when you looked at what you could get for a subscription and what it would cost you to produce it? How do you set these kind of parameters?
Just had basically numbers. You know, we knew what it cost to process an article, and we can only cover so many. I mean, many a year we went over our quota, and then we'd have to cut back. Mm-hmm. But fundamentally, it was not a good idea to do that. Because you disappoint people. You get them used to having a journal, and then it's dropped, and, you know. I mean, theoretically, the idea was that if you started a journal in current contents, if after a couple of years the damn thing wasn't being cited by anybody, what's the point? There are a lot of other journals that could be put in, which might be used more.
And this was
still, the core is what is the dominant thing. I mean, there's always going to be another new journal coming out, those new journals that you're going to have to consider. And to the people that get that journal, it's the most important journal in the world. We had many a campaign waged here where 50 to 100 people would be writing the identical letter saying Magnesium is one of them. A journal called Magnesium Research or something. We must have got 100 letters. And we knew that it was a calculated campaign. Not that you could ignore it, but it's not quite the same as spontaneous people writing in.
Yeah.
You know, a half a dozen people writing in and saying, gee, why don't you cover such and such a journal? And you realize that you've got a gap.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you look at it, and made a point.
Well, the synergy of the two projects together must have been nice with the citation literature counts available to you.
Yeah. And right. Well, there always were more journals covered in CC than SCI, simply because of the extra cost.
Right.
And people sort of assumed that if it was in current content, gee, it ought to be in the SCI. Well, no. But there were a lot of journals in CC that were in there not for so much for their merit as for, you know, borderline interest. I mean, we would cover a certain Russian or a Japanese journal because of the general interest, to get an idea of what was going on there, not because the Russian journal of whatever biology they have was so good, but because this would tell people here what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
So current content served a newspaper function like that.
No.
It
wasn't, right.
So it could cover more, and so you could afford to do a little bit of that. But then you got criticized for not the indexing. But they were indexed if they got, after a while, when we started our indexes to current contents, they were retrievable.
When did current contents make a profit?
It was making a profit, certainly, by the time we started the citation indexes. Sure, that's how we could afford to take that risk. And after we did the genetics project and had to launch the SCI, 65, it was the profits from current contents that kept it going. We came close to going under.
So you were making enough money to hold off or help the cash flow.
Yeah, and then in a kind of people got scared, so we sold 20% of the company for $500,000 in convertible debenture. They got a sweet deal, and never really needed the money.
I saw something about that in the interview. Talk about that. You called it a mistake in accounting, right? That you had an accountant who made some kind of mistake?
I don't know about a mistake. I just think that they were overly conservative.
In terms of forecasting cash flow?
Yeah, right.
And so it was really not a necessary thing to go with that outside.
Well, as it turned out, but I mean, I suppose you could say, well, if those subscriptions hadn't come in, what would you have done?
Mm-hmm.
Hindsight's always a little better than foresight. But,
yeah.
Anyhow, that's a little bit of panic.
Yeah. The subscriptions to SCI.
If we waited too long, then it would have been much more costly to get money.
Yeah.
Because once you're on the verge of disaster, then you pay a higher price.
Right. So, yeah. Well, let's talk about citation indexing.
Maybe there would have been other actions taken. Maybe if we didn't have that money, we would have killed the Index Chemicus, which was losing money, and which caused a rebellion here because I kept it going for all those years.
Yeah,
always different choices that you have.
I want to come back to that in a minute, talk about Index Chemicus and that rebellion from the few hints that I picked up in the previous interview. You've talked about how you got the idea, so we won't go through that for citation indexing. But I was curious, when I talked with Mr. Herner, he said he thought you had gotten a little bit of your idea for the citation index from his user studies, where they had showed that the users kept saying how important
references
were. And,
well, that fed into it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that, in other words, that made me more conscious,
more aware
of the significance of those things.
Why did it take so long to get the idea of the citation index into production? You had the basic idea in 52, wrote your science article in 55, but it really isn't until late 60, early 61 that you got the grant to do GCI.
So?
Is that what it took? Did you...
Well, why, I did experimental indexes.
You did?
Oh, yeah. We did a patent citation index, even, with those friends of mine from the pharmaceutical industry.
The pharmaceutical industry. Okay.
But it was a chemical patent citation index. So what was I supposed to do? Why didn't I launch a commercial service when I knew that? Nobody was that convinced. And where was the money going to come from?
Yeah.
I didn't have the money to do that. I hadn't even started current contents. You're talking about way back. Mm-hmm. This is still research. So in a certain sense, the genetics index came pretty early on in things. I mean, it was amazing. It was still really research. I mean, it was...
Now, part of what became Index Chemicus, you had tried, as you say, experimental citation indexes as part of that project, huh?
No, Index Chemicus...
Or the patent project had...
No, you've got confusing two different patent things. One was a patent citation index, which was simply an experimental project, which was done between me and Marge Corain of Merck up in Rahway. She loaned me her processed the patents that she had in her collection and did the punch card work. And as a result of that, we produced an experimental citation index to those 4,000 patents.
Oh, really?
And that was what permitted me to do the paper that I published in 1957 in the Journal of the Patent Office Society. Okay. Now that is completely separate from a project where we got a contract from the Pharmaceutical Manufacturers Association to encode the steroid chemical compounds in the U.S., in the literature, in the published literature, so that the U.S. Patent Office could do searches on that literature in connection with patent filings. And it was as a result of our doing that indexing of the literature that I became aware that within every one of these articles that we were indexing, not by chemical formula, but by the coding system that the patent office set up. Okay. Mr. Andrews at the patent office was the guy that supplied the code sheets. But it was there that I realized that every paper you had to report a molecular formula when you, it was a sine qua non of a new compound. So I realized that you could go through these papers almost blindfolded and you could circle that molecular formula. And it was the molecular formula that I then used to create a molecular formula index, okay, while I was a consultant at Smith Klein, okay, and I did a calculation to show what it would take to extend it to the 100 core journals, and I went to Glenn Olliott, among others, at Smith Klein, and none of them would believe me. He, in particular, he is still to this day an American Chemical Society stalwart. He sponsors the Glenn Olliott research lectures. He's a sweet guy, you know. I mean, I like him very much. But Glenn would not believe it, neither would anybody else, when I told him that for $25,000 a year, I could produce an up-to-date monthly, weekly molecular formula index to the entire core literature. So you're going to do what Chemical Abstracts with all they can't do, because they did not recognize that I had found this key to doing it very simply. I wasn't going to use chemists to do this. I needed them eventually to do it because of the way it eventually turned out. Now, they said absolutely not. I said, you give me permission as your consultant to do this on my own? They said, go ahead and we'll be one of your customers. Okay? So instead of $25,000, they got it for $2,000. And I lined up 12 other companies, or 12, 10, 11, Park Davis and the others, and got them each to commit $2,000. And then we had this meeting, and then eventually Max Gordon was one of the people who supported me at Smith Klein. They said, well, gee, a molecular formula index is fine, but what we really need is this. We need something with an abstract and the molecular formulas graphically displayed, okay? And that's how Index Chemicus was born. And then that's the format it had. And so it had a molecular formula index based on that indexing. And then we had to start calculating formulas ourselves for a lot of the stuff. It turned out that should be covered because it was intermediates that were mentioned and not necessarily indexed and so on and so forth, you know. And so that's the way it got off the ground.
Well, let's talk about that, because this is the idea for the algorithm that you do for the doctoral work at Penn, right? These two
ideas. Yeah, it's related exactly,
right?
Yeah.
I mean, this is the same algorithm that we're talking about here.
Well, not exactly, but the idea was I had thought, you know, we could feed in, yes, a chemical name.
Mm-hmm.
And compute the molecular formula for it. Exactly. Of course, we're related.
Mm-hmm. But in Index Chemicus, it didn't quite turn out that way?
No, Irv Schur invented a little slide rule for calculating molecular formulas.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, which one of those should be around somewhere.
Yeah.
I hope. I think we got someone somewhere. But
and that was what you used in Index Chemicus, or
well, yeah. But we didn't, as I said, it was basically that. People, you know, learn algorithmically to do that.
Yeah. Well, now, see, without having any kind of chemistry background, my ability to come at this and ask really good questions, but I was trying to sort out what eventually happens with particularly at CAS, with Chem Abstracts, and the development of the connection table, and your idea about the algorithm, and then what you did in Index Chemicus.
Well, they were all separate. I mean, at CA, of course, the connectivity tables. We eventually also used connectivity tables for the Whisk-Wessler notation.
Uh-huh. How did you
that
make...
That came later.
Oh, it did? Okay.
Yeah, we didn't have Whisk-Wessler in the very beginning. It came later.
You were using what at the very beginning for Index Chemicus?
All that we did was manually extracted the molecular formula from the published paper.
Uh-huh. And indexed using that.
We took the author's word for it, assumed it was correct. Mm-hmm. Now maybe occasionally they would check the accuracy of it, on the slide rule.
Uh-huh.
But fundamentally, they were usually correct.
Mm-hmm.
And so.
And then later you picked up the Whisk-Wessler line notation system and used that.
Right.
Were you paying anything to that association for use of that?
What association? That was Bill Whisk-Wessler's.
Well, there's a Whisk-Wessler line notation system association that existed at some point.
No, they were thrilled to get the damn thing used.
Yeah. Well,
I think we used him as a consultant.
Yeah.
I don't know whether we paid him, but I think we used him. Bill was a consultant for a while. Of course, there were problems using any notation system. Always were exceptions that came up and so on.
Yeah. Well, now, what gets used out of the algorithm that you use for the dissertation in Index Chemicus?
It never really got used.
It didn't. Why is that?
Because we weren't keyboarding, and that's the whole point of it. We wanted to avoid it. We didn't want to have to get involved in dealing with the names of the compounds. I mean, that's the whole story of my life. We were avoiding nomenclature, avoiding titles. That's what you can do with citation indexes. You can retrieve information without getting involved with the titles. And same thing with chemical compounds. You can get involved with, you can retrieve these things without getting involved with their names.
Yeah. Index Chemicus made money?
Not for a long, long time.
Long time.
I would probably guess didn't make money for 20 years.
20 years. And you...
Maybe, I don't know when they started making money. I can't...
Yeah.
May not have been making money. We're lucky if we broke even when I sold the company. Because I wouldn't be a bit surprised if they thought seriously about it being killed around here.
After you sold.
Yeah. Listen, even if it made profit, how much profit?
Because of the competition with CAS?
Well, whatever reasons, I mean, it couldn't make money. I mean, yeah, it was not... people are not going to drop Chemical Abstracts to buy Index Chemicus. It serves a different purpose. So you're catering to a very specialized market, which is highly industrial. And those universities that have an industry-related work.
Yeah. You said there was an internal revolt over your decision to keep publishing.
Yeah, the... knowing we were losing money on Index Chemicus, we tried to come up with an alternative product. And for a while, we published a chemical edition of Current Contents, which had in it molecular formulas that were cut out of the original articles. Okay. And we tried to push that as a substitute for Index Chemicals. It just didn't fly. Okay. We also covered in there chemical patents, by the way. Now, if that...